You know, it would be so easy for Jeff Daniels. 84 screen credits to his name, a successful theater in Chelsea in Southeast Michigan. He also performs to crowds of adoring fans as a touring musician. And since we last spoke with him, he had a starring role as Atticus Finch on Broadway that won rave reviews. I mean, does a guy like that really have to keep on keeping it interesting? Fortunately for us, Jeff Daniels does not do coasting, and he stopped in recently to speak with us about recent work. Can we start talking for just a minute about your work on the 2018-29 production of To Kill a Mockingbird?
Absolutely.
This was an adaptation written by Aaron Sorkin, of The West Wing, of course. It was praised for not falling back on the much-beloved literary classic that we all know, and instead making Atticus Finch a bit less immediately heroic. He had to find his way into doing the right thing. What did you notice about how audiences reacted to the show?
It was fascinating because I was in the show for a year. And the different waves of audiences that would come through. Initially, when the curtain first went up on those first 10 or so shows, you could feel the audience who had read the book because they brought the book and they were holding the book like the Bible against their chest. And out I come, and I'm not Gregory Peck. I knew he wasn't going to be. I was open to it, but now I can see it, and I'm trying really hard. That was initially. And then we would get him. We'd pull him in because Sorkin moved things around. He was able to write some scenes that aren't in the book, that aren't in the movie, like when Atticus goes to the jail and meets Tom Robinson. That's in the first 15 minutes of the play. And so things like that threw them off, but that we were certainly, faithful to what Harper might have written, but we were doing what Sorkin was going to do. And it allowed us to do something different with Atticus, which was, in the movie, he's Mount Rushmore. It's an 8-year-old's point of view looking up at Atticus Finch. And Peck played him that way, and it was written that way. In the play, Scout is late 20s, talking to the audience about what happened to her 20 years ago. And so we go back and we see from her point of view, being older, Atticus go from being a simple small town lawyer who handles land disputes, service agreements, and foreclosures, and can write a will. Those are the things he does. That's it. And he's trying to raise his two kids. And then the judge comes over one day and says, I got this criminal case I think you should take because it's a slam dunk. And he takes it. And then his life is changed.
The way we see our parents as adults is so radically different.
Yeah. And that's where Sorkin went. So you see Atticus Finch become Atticus Finch in the play. And by doing that, and all the other things that Sorkin and Bart Scheer, the director, did, and the cast – We like to say you watch the movie, you read the book, you feel the play. Audiences were knocked out by it, and they had even the ones who knew the book and knew the movie.
You are a pretty fearless person. You've played roles that are on every point of the continuum of audience sympathy, but was it at all scary to try to take on such a beloved character in such a different way?
Yeah, it had risk written all over. It had risk and failure written all over it. Did Gregory Peck give the definitive performance? Was he the definitive Atticus Finch? Or was he the only guy who got to do it? And I have to take the latter. Or I can't walk on stage. You can't walk on stage worrying about Gregory Peck. So you have to hit the delete button. And he doesn't exist anymore because you're originating the role. And in a way, you are, because he didn't play it this way. It wasn't this script. And we're not doing Horton Foote screenplay on stage. And so it is an originate. I am originating the role. And so that you have to, especially on Broadway, especially in front of the critics, walk out there and challenge them. It took me decades to learn that. But you have to do the work, you have to prepare, you have to be disciplined, you have to outwork everyone else. then you have earned the right to walk out there and the critics are in the audience on opening night or whenever, and write almost, you turn to them and go, keep up.
We've benefited from decades of your stage performances now. Why do you feel so strongly, as someone who's got this huge film repertoire as well, about maintaining a career in live theater?
There's nothing like it. Movies are moments. Shooting movies are just grabbing little moments here and there that someone else is going to put together in about 3 months. And that scene or that speech that you did isn't in the movie anymore. You have more control of your art when you're standing on stage in front of 1,400 people at Schubert Theater and you're doing the closing argument from To Kill a Mockingbird. It's you. You have complete control. You're directed. It is written. But you're the one who executes it. And there is something to be said for all the actors who went to Broadway, who went through the theater, who know what it means to go 8 shows a week for a year. Henry Fonda did it in Mr. Roberts. People like Lee J. Cobb did it, Jason Robards, Alec Guinness, Olivier. The greats did it. So I don't think you can be a great actor unless you're also a great theater actor. Because I know I've done both. And you can't get away with as much on stage. In fact, you can't get away with much of anything. But you can be terrible on film, and they just cut it.
The theater that you founded in Chelsea, Purple Rose, has been producing new work since 1991. When I realized that's how long it's been going on, the first thing I thought of, you're talking about a theater operating on the mandate of bringing people the classics they don't know yet. The first thing I thought of was, what has it been like to keep it going?
You don't keep something like this going without the help of a great board of directors, with supporters and donors, because we are the sole reason for us to be a nonprofit is so that the price is as affordable as possible. Said a guy who just came from Broadway where it was $200 a ticket. Can't do that. Theater won't survive at that price. And it's simply a price point on Broadway because people will pay it. And I got this at Circle Rep in New York. We have nothing if there is no connection between what's going on stage and the audience. You have to have a connection. And I think we've made that connection. And we know how to develop plays. It's just the shark's got to keep swimming, you know. The creative part of me, it's just got to keep going. And it's the same with all of those people. It's what's the next play? What's the next thing we're doing? It's this act of creation that is keeping me going. And I think it's connected with this audience. I think there's an audience that understands that what we're doing at the Purple Rose isn't like anything else. And that after almost 30 years, what keeps me going is that I can put up what we do. You could drop it in Chicago. You drop it in New York, L.A. And we would more than hold our own.
Well, I know how beloved it is within theater circles just because there's been so much of what has kept playwrights going over the past decade or so is their side work in TV. And yeah. Just having a home for something that is original work is so rare. It's interesting that you feel the audience growth has gone along side by side with that.
They trust us now. They don't come. Initially, in the first 10 years or so, they came just because there might be a chance I might be in the lobby. That's okay. Whatever gets you in the door. But now they're coming to see what the Purple Rose is doing next. That thrills me.
The newest production is Road Signs, which you wrote. And the play starts in a small club with 50-something folk singer Lanny Wilson telling the story of how the song that people are hearing came to be. We should explain that Lanny is sort of the avatar for the playwright and your close friend, Lanford Wilson. And then the play takes the audience along on a bus ride with Wilson the teenager going inside his mind as he encounters interesting characters. I should say, I'm sorry, I think I misspoke. You co-wrote this play with your son, Ben, didn't you?
Well, I wrote the play, Ben and I wrote the music.
Okay. What was your approach?
1978, I was doing, I think it was 5th of July, and John Hogan, who's another actor, Circle rep, he and I were sitting in the dressing room off-Broadway, playing guitars, writing songs. We're in our early 20s. Songs are horrible. I look up, there's Lanford Wilson, who would go on to become a Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright, saying, and he said to me, he goes, you write songs? I said, yes. He goes, let me help. And he handed me a poem. It was about a bus trip he took from Missouri up to Chicago when he was a young man. And it was just full of the imagery and those people, those forgotten people that he wrote about in all his plays. And so I put some music to it and, you know, played it on the guitar, and he liked it, and we kind of had it, and that was our little thing that we had. And Hogan got a song. He gave Hogan a song. And it wasn't until after, you know, 25, 30 years of Purple Rose, and I said, I think maybe there's a play in Road Signs. And it became this very personal journey for me. It's a tribute to the artist, the American artist. It's a tribute to those folk singers who come to the Ark or would love to get to the Ark. And they rent the car and they hit five clubs, and sometimes they play to 18 people, and they're great. It's a tribute to the songwriters who never get to see the light because they can't really sing as well as Garth Brooks or something. It's a tribute to all those artists. And it's the story of how he wrote the song. And you see this guy, and if we can pull it off, you're in this guy's imagination as he creates these people who are on the bus. And then by the end of it, there's this song called Road Signs, and all these people are alive and walking around and singing right in front of you. It's unlike anything we've ever done at the Purple Rose.
She says, me, my sister, we strut our stuff. Those Motown jivers, they got nothing on us, I'm a singer.
As Lanford Wilson was writing so movingly about people and situations on the margin, he wasn't a writer who was just interested in quirky characters for the sake of quirk. You know, there was a depth of character study there. How did he affect your view of story and character?
He was always able to find heart in his plays, but he got there on the back roads of that character. He got there in ways that, as you look at story structure, and this is what I loved about Lanford the most. You go to Hollywood and there's a formula to do the story, and how to write a screenplay. And on page 29, this has to happen. And on page 59, it's just like a mathematical formula, story structure. And it really starts to smell like formula when you watch and they don't really write around it. Mm-hmm. Lanford would not only write around it, he would move it around and confuse you so you don't quite know where you are, and all of a sudden you just got a right hook. That was his brilliance, the way he hid structure with the imagery that seemingly only he could have written it this way. But, you know, that's what the true artists do. You can't imagine anyone else doing it.
What would you say his relationship meant to you?
He found
his friendship, I should say. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, he was a true artist, as was Marshall W. Mason, the artistic director of Circle Rep. But Lanford just clicked with me more because I didn't want to be a director. I wanted to be a writer. And so I just was fascinated by his process, and I learned at his feet about writing plays, about writing, period, about what matters, about don't sell out, about be an artist. I mean, I remember talking to Lanford when he was hurting for money, and I said, doctor a screenplay, for God's sake. They're offering you $100,000 to be the third writer on a movie no one's going to know that you were even on. Take it. Nope, I'm a playwright. Movies are bupkis, which is his way of saying, I'm an artist.
I can't help but think about the trajectory of your own career. You've worked with so many amazing directors over the years and done movies that people would consider lighter, as well as, fortified yourself with all your stage work over the years. What is your approach to making the work that you want to do while doing the things that you must do?
I've kind of arrived at it. Once you've done Atticus Finch on Broadway, there is no, you are at the top of the mountain. I remember in the show, just during the run of that, and he's going, this is not the gig that you call your agent and say, get me something better. There is nothing better than Atticus Finch on Broadway. And with those reviews and those audiences. So now it really is, what do you want to do? And the things, and that's different for everybody, but for me, it's I want to continue to be challenged as an actor. That's why I'm doing this. I'm doing James Comey. I'm playing Comey in the James Comey. He wrote a book called Higher Loyalty, and we're shooting that right now.
A four-part CBS original series.
CBS or Showtime. I don't think they know yet, but they're excited about it. But I went into that going, I don't know how to do this.
In what sense?
Don't know how to do this.
To play James Comey?
Yeah. And we start in 2 weeks. Now, I'd been reading on him. I'd been listening to the voice. But to go from a character like Atticus Finch that after a year, 415 performances, you could write a dissertation on him, to someone where you're guessing, that's jumping off the cliff and flapping your arms and hoping you fly. And that, for an actor, at this point, for me, is exciting.
See, it seems to me we can argue whether or not Jim Comey was serving some kind of self-interest in coming mm-hmm. forward the way he did, but it seems to me there's not that much of a jump between Atticus Finch trying to find his way through to doing the right thing and Jim Comey being in this total bind of American politics.
Yeah, their commonalities were that they both believed in the rule of law and doing the right thing. I mean, they have that in common. And they're not the only two guys who think like that. You can go down the list of those people who came into the hearings in the House. Yovanovitch, Taylor, Fiona Hill, for God's sake. These are apolitical people who are there to do the right thing, follow the law wherever it may lead.
And career people within their fields.
Yes, but apolitical. And they're aware of left and right, and they are aware of the consequences, and they have to follow the facts, and this is what the law says you have to do right now.
It sounds like you've been diving in pretty deeply on the testimony and other aspects related to Comey's story.
Yeah, you're going to grad school on James Comey, yeah.
Anything you learned? I mean, we've all been sort of hanging on the edge of our seats for the past 4 years on some of these events. But was there anything that stood out to you, either about him or about this moment in politics?
It wasn't everything he did was thought out and discussed with a team. He did have final say. He struggled with every one of those decisions. He had the choice between really, really bad and catastrophic. And you have to choose one of those. You can't not, and doing nothing is one of them in some cases. So just finding out about that and kind of just as an actor, your job isn't to judge him or to make you think that he's good or to make you think that he's bad. It's to just show you what he was thinking. That's all we're doing. We want you to know what he's thinking, his struggle, and why he did what he did. And yes, everything blew up when he did it.
You're working opposite Brendan Gleeson for this production, who's got the role of Donald Trump. I wonder how he's going about that aspect of the role.
We just want to show you what and this is also from Comey's point of view. It is from his book. So Trump will be Trump, and everything that Brendan says is taken from Trump's mouth. He said everything that he says,
but colored through Comey's perspective.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And the interesting thing for me about Comey, even in his relationship with Trump, but also with other people, is that some people said Comey was, he was right, he had a higher sense of loyalty, a higher sense of truth, just like Atticus Finch, and yes, it was the right thing to do. And others say he was self-righteous. Others say he was self-interested. So it's been fun to thread the needle on moments where he was either seeing a higher truth or he was being self-righteous, a little bit above you. My truth is better than your truth. And so it's been fun to kind of at least present a gray area in some of those moments where people can go, which is it?
How are you feeling about the possibility for doing interesting work in the environment that we find ourselves in now, where there are still traditional model studio movies, but so many on-demand productions popping up? I mean, you're in a place, as you say, where you can choose a little bit more. But is there anything that you feel is available to writers and directors and actors on this landscape that maybe wasn't there 30 years ago?
The reason I'm still in the business is because of pay TV. The Netflixes, the Hulus, the HBOs, the Showtimes, Amazons, on and on and on. It is a wild west for actors, right, and particularly for writers. I've found that in the ones I've done, Newsroom, Looming Tower, Godless, they're like novels. We're shooting novels, and we get to play 10 chapters. And especially if it's a limited series, then you've got a three-act structure, a beginning, middle, and end. But you have 10 hours of it, not just an hour, 2 hours or less, so it can fit into a movie theater's time schedule. You get to shoot the whole novel. And for actors, for writers, that's just, it's kind of great. And there's so much content, which is, you keep wondering for it all. It just kind of, there's just too much out there. And then we get to the world where nobody's watching anything.
I don't think we're there yet.
I don't think we are either. But there, it's niche marketing. Like Godless was a movie that we did for Netflix. And Scott Frank was the writer-director. It was a two-hour Western. He tried to get it made at a movie studio for 15 years. Nobody wanted to do Westerns. And then Netflix appeared. And now Netflix said, yeah, we'll meet on that. And take your two-hour script. Could you make it 6 hours, maybe seven? Then we'll do it. For a writer?
Twist my arm.
That's how Godless happened. And now we're shooting it on Netflix. And he gets to spread the story out. Not just the A story, but also supporting characters that in the movie kind of just pushed the plot and then went away. Now they have beginning, middles, and ends. And there becomes this layered fabric of story that if you've ever read a good book, will pull you in just like that. For me, it was all about the beard.
Yeah. A case where the facial hair kind of does the work.
He did.
For
Scott
you.
Said, I see the guy with a little bit of a stubble, kind of like Henry Fonda in that Italian Western that I can't remember. And I said, yeah, okay, like a quarter inch. Yeah, okay. It was June. And I showed up in September with that. And then he goes, keep it.
If you're just joining us, I'm speaking with actor, playwright, and musician Jeff Daniels. As if all this weren't enough, you have maintained a life on stage playing in a band with your son, Ben. I believe managed by your son, Lucas, when you're on the road. Yeah?
Yeah.
What is the live music experience like for you these days?
I really enjoy it. It allows me to do what I can't do on stage as an actor, is to deviate from the script. I love the aliveness of it. There are certainly things that are set up, written almost after many performances, but there are other times where I just veer off. And it's fun, it's exciting, it's very present, and I get to control everything, especially if I'm solo. I'm the writer, the director, the actor, the editor, I'm everything. And I like that, because in my other parts of my life, those jobs are handed over to others. And I like the freedom that comes with that.
What kind of bars do you guys play?
Bars?
Excuse me. What kind of theatrical venues does the band play?
I played bars.
Yeah.
I played a bar in Montana that was really – I love Missoula, Montana. We love it. It was a great night.
What are you looking for in an ideal venue for the band?
I like places like the Arc. I like the Listening Rooms. We tour the Northeast. They've got a lot of places like the Arc. Cafe Lena was fun just for the history of it in upstate New York. I like to go to the offbeat places like Oshkosh, Wisconsin. And they've got an opera house, not like the Michigan Theater, but pretty good. And they put $1 million renovation. It's their town jewel. And you show up and yeah, maybe they're coming because of Dumb and Dumber or Newsroom, but you pack the place. And then all you got to do is play and make sure they have a great time and drop in some of the stuff that you enjoy. And next thing you know, they've had a great night. And constantly we would play, and after the show, people would come up and go, thank you for coming here. Most people don't.
It sounds kind of amazing to see America through the lens of small-ish towns that have really made the effort to keep their main streets alive and have some place for people to come play.
Just the opera houses. The opera houses all over this country. I'm whenever Jim Fleming, who's my musical agent, he says, it's an opera house. It's in God knows where, Idaho. I'm interested.
Forgive me for not knowing this, but do you guys have any road dates this winter?
There are no dates right now. No, I'm
you're
tired.
Working.
Yeah. I'm going to do the Comey thing till the end of February, and then I start something else with the guys who wrote Looming Tower, Danny Futterman and Adam Rapp. We're going to do a series for Showtime starting in March that'll take me into the summer.
Jeff Daniels, a real pleasure. Thank you for coming.
Thanks, April.
Road Signs, written by Jeff Daniels, opens at the Purple Rose Theater in Chelsea this week. Support for arts and culture coverage comes in part from the Michigan Council for Arts and Cultural Affairs.